morning, everybody. We are today learning Perek Hey, fifth chapter of the Sivat Shuva. We'll see what happens. We're going to start it. We'll get that. Okay. What we're going to learn today is the Maharal continuing in his way of the Nesivat Shuvah, where he brings different statements of Chazal about Tshuva, like he does. Remember, the Nesivat Shuvah is part of the Nesivos Olam, which is a topically organized work on various basic topics of Torah. And on each topic, he brings a whole number of statements which Chazal make, and then he offers words of explanation about them. And here, he's going to be doing the same, and as we will see in Yirtzeh Hashem, it's pretty consistent. We've established in the first sections of the Netzivat Tshuva the Maharal's core principles of Tshuva, and his explanations here of these different Mamore Chazal are going to be expressions of those principles. One principle for this one principle for that one. So the first one which the Maharal brings, and interestingly, he starts the Perek, unlike he does in many of these Prakim, where he just goes straight out of the box with the Mamar Chazal, starts, you know, immediately with the, you know, the quotation of Chazal, like last Perek, the Perek Einaimdim, and he started bringing the Gemara about the Baal HaTshuva here. He starts off and he says, Ikar v'yisoid gadol l'tshuva, a foundational principle of a root and foundational principle for tshuva is she's bayish bal ha-tshuva min ha-chet she'asa, that when a person is doing tshuva, they should feel some level of shame about what they did. U'bishvil kach mekabel na'isa b'tshuva, and it helps in the tshuva process. Now this is something which is established. It's in, you know, as Rabbi Hartman brings in his footnote, that it's, you know, the fifth of the 20 principles of tshuva of Rabbeinu Yonah, right? And it's all over the place, you know, this kind of an idea. So he establishes it in a sense even before he brings the specific Gemara that he wants to use to illustrate this and to discuss. So feeling a certain sense of shame at what was done. I know shame is a little bit of a dirty word. You know, like people worry about shame. If you're, you know, shame, it maybe it's like this debilitating kind of notion of guilt. And of course, there is such a thing as, like with guilt, there's such a thing as when it's debilitating and non-productive. And there's such a thing as a shame that is, you know, a healthy shame that a person should feel under certain circumstances. It would be better if he didn't have to, but given the circumstance, it's good for a person to feel that shame. When Adam and Chava sinned, they realized that they were unclothed and they covered themselves up, right? So that they were embarrassed. There was shame. So we would say, you know something, we're not going to cover ourselves up because we feel we shouldn't be ashamed. Right? Yeah, obviously, it's the shame under those circumstances is something which is important for the person to feel. What is it? What is it? We speak here specifically about the shame of chet. What is it? What is it that we that is significant about that? What element of tshuva does it tap into to make the tshuva profound? So the Maharal is going to explain this, and first, in doing so, he brings the Gemara in Brachas, where a Chanina said, "Kol ha'oser dvar avera u'mizbayish meichel le'kol avinoisav." A person who does a dvar avera, who does a matter of sin, u'mizbayish, and he's ashamed, he's forgiven for all of his sins. And the Gemara brings a pasuk, and it tries that, and then it brings another pasuk. And, you know, interestingly, the ultimate illustration which the Gemara brings is from Shaul HaMelech, where, if you remember, at a certain point, when Shaul HaMelech was struggling with his struggle with David HaMelech and so on and so forth, and he was going to war, so Shaul used a balas oiv. He used a sorceress to summon up a spirit in order to be able to get an answer to his question. And whose spirit did she summon up? None other than Shmuel Anavi, who had already passed away, who had already died. So the thing, so Shmuel comes to Shaul and he says to him, why did you disturb me? Why did you bring me back? And Shaul sort of is apologetic, but he says, what can I do? Hashem didn't answer me through prophets. Hashem didn't answer me through dreams. So I'm stuck. So I needed to know what to do. So that's why I resorted to this. Says the Gemara, what do you notice? What's another way where one would get guidance about going to battle? What's the classic way one would get guidance about going to battle? Is the Urim V'Tumim, to go to the Kohen Gadol and to have the breastplate light up and tell him what to do. Says the Gemara, why did Shaul not say that? He didn't answer me through Nevi'im, through Chalaimais, through the Urim V'Tumim. Why didn't he mention that? Says the Gemara, the reason why he didn't mention that is that as part of Shaul's unfortunate elements of his track record was that he killed Nov, the city of Kohanim. What happened was, when David was on the run from Shaul, so David ran, and one place where he stopped was Nov, the city of the Kohanim, and he had nothing to eat. They didn't know that he was running away from Shaul. They just knew David, who was a significant person already, known for his battle against Goliath the Plishti, and they gave him to eat. They gave him a sword. And when Shaul found out about this, together with Doeg HaAdomi, he had the city of Nov killed. It's a terrible story. But at this point, right, Shaul therefore didn't want to say, and he didn't answer me from the Urim V'Tumim. Why? Because he was embarrassed. Because he knew that he had done something to affect, to ruin the position of the Kohanim. I mean, they were still Kohanim, right? But he had ruined it. So therefore, to expect that he'd be able to solicit a response through the Urim V'Tumim, forget about it. So therefore, he didn't mention it. And the Gemara took it as not mentioning it was a matter that he was embarrassed about what he had done. And the Gemara goes on to show that we find that Shaul was forgiven. Shaul was forgiven. So you see that a person who feels shame is forgiven for his averus. That's what the Gemara says. And as we started, as the Maral notes, as Rabbeinu Yehuda says, others, shame is an important part of the tshuva process in any case. Right? Whether you're going to say something as dramatic as what this Gemara says, that if a person's embarrassed, zip, it's all gone, or just it's an important part of the tshuva process, it's more of like a practical step. What's the significance of it? What would you say? I think this...
You're low, so therefore you're...
Okay, interesting. Maybe if he's embarrassed, so he's humbled. And therefore, as the humble, the humility allows him to become closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nice.
Well, shame is the internal acknowledgement that you've done something wrong.
Okay. Shame is conscience. And you still have a conscience. It's the internal acknowledgement that you've done something wrong. And therefore, it's not, in a sense, because it's embarrassment, it's even more than saying it, People could sometimes go through the motions, say the words, I'm sorry, and not really feel sorry. But a person can't feel shame without feeling it. That's not something to be simulated. It's a very real feeling of conscience of it. The way the Maharal phrases it, and you understand it in the context of his core principles, says the Maharal, shame from the sin shows distance from the sin. One of the core principles which the Maral established for us in tshuva is that the way tshuva works is because you show that it's not really part and parcel of who you are. The sin is an incidental. At the core, you're right, you're good, you made a mistake, you did something wrong. Whether it's the principle of shkoga, of not thinking about it, whether just the core principle, that at the core, the person is good and right and connected to Hashem. Now sometimes that core is visible and sometimes that core is invisible. We might say, what do you mean? Every person, right? The Rambam says, Every person has programmed into their being that they're supposed, that they want to do the right thing. That's the neshama. The neshama is divine. It comes from Hashem. So everybody has it. However, if it's so latent that it doesn't awaken a feeling of shame and it within the person about what it was, about what he said, about what he did, so then it may be academic. That pintala yid that we speak about, you know, that core of goodness may be so caked over that this idea of that core connection to Hashem isn't there. But when the conscience is still alive, when the person is aysed dvar avera umisbayish hemena, when they feel uncomfortable about what they did, then it's a whole different story. That shows how distant the person is from it, even though they might have done it. That they haven't allowed themselves to integrate it as part of it. Now, we've talked about this idea before. Sometime recently we spoke about the idea of Over, I think maybe last time, Over Adam Avera Vishana Banasis Loikeheter. If a person does something a few times, then it's as if it's okay already. Right? He does it a couple of times, Nasis Loikeheter, it's as if it's permitted. What does that mean? And why does that make the sin so much more difficult to do tshuva for? Because once it becomes habitual, so what do? You erase the conscience component from it. And the conscience component is so important in the sense that we can, when there's the conscience, you understand, okay, I failed, I wasn't able to do it, but there's still a certain non-identity with the chet, non-identity with the sin. And that's so essential to tshuva. There are many places in Chazal where we find this idea. There are places in Halacha where we find this idea. And I mentioned to you, I think once, the idea that, you know, we have a halachic distinction between a person who desecrates the Shabbos b'parhesia, publicly, and a person who desecrates the Shabbos b'tzina, privately. They have different status in terms of halacha. A person's mechal Shabbos, a person who desecrates Shabbos publicly has a certain compromised halachic status that the person who does it just privately doesn't. What's the definition of doing it publicly? And so the Paiskim say that if the person is self-conscious about what they've done, even if they might do it where other people see, well, let's say a certain person, the rabbi passes by, so they'll stop, or they'll try to turn away. If the person shows that they still see it as something that they should be doing, even if they're not, and that manifests itself in a certain degree of shame, then they're still connected to the mitzvah. They're still connected to the mitzvah. The problem becomes when you say it's not my issue. The problem becomes when you say it's not my issue. If you study Rabbeinu Yonah's Sharei Tshuva, this is a very important distinction which he makes in a couple places, even not speaking about busha, not speaking about embarrassment. The distinction between someone who's not perfect but understands that they're not living up to what they should be doing, and the person who, by contrast, chooses the other tack, which is a different kind of mechanism, which we do. It says they can't accept that they're not perfect. And so instead they say, this is not important. This is not binding. That is fundamentally different. That's, you know, in the words of Rabbeinu Yonah, Kfar Shavar Oil Adonav Me'olav. And it's as if he's, you know, he's not even thinking about. He's written off what Hashem wants, at least in this particular area, and that can broaden. But the idea where the person doesn't aver and feels shame shows that his heart. I mean, it sounds so trite, but his heart is in the right place. But that he's still fundamentally connected, and that mechanism of tshuva, which says, at the core, he's right, and this is just something that has to be wiped off. That's something just superficial that he did that became sort of like adhered to him. The notion or the ability for the person to feel shame demonstrates that. So that's Chazal number one. Questions, comments? Yeah.
Why is it so far-reaching, the internal acknowledgement, that it's mocha akhol of us? Why is it just that I feel shame about action A? Let's say Shaul felt shame about. Shaul felt shame about the nov.
massacre, but maybe he didn't feel shame. Why would it be that in the Yudhishthira Sanasi that all of his chantayim were now forgiven?
Right. So the Maharal does not address that piece of it. The Maharal does not address that piece of it. Maybe in the second paragraph about it, the third paragraph, or whatever, Vayesh Chaladas, he's addressing it a little bit more specifically, but he doesn't address it as such. Why on everything, if he's embarrassed about a specific thing? And so he doesn't. Maral doesn't address it explicitly. In other places, it says the idea, and it's sort of really just an extension of this, and just it's a next step. It's a next step, but it's an extension of this. Busha, shame, is you can see it narrowly as I'm embarrassed of this, so that's distancing myself from this particular act. But busha, because it's an emotion. And who's he embarrassed of, right? He feels a certain, my soul is not where it needs to be. That embarrassment in itself creates connection to where it needs to be. When on an emotional level I feel, I'm far away, this was the particular manifestation. This was the particular thing that I did that I'm thinking about now that stimulated it. But it's part of a fuller picture. And when the person feels the distance, that's a general feeling. It's a general feeling. It's not just this particular action. So that's the Meichel Me'al Kol. It serves to reconnect. You know, you see it. I mean, there's a practical expression of that. You know, a person goes through something and they're failing and they're weak in a specific area. They're weak in many, many areas. But then they rock bottom. In what? Now, it may be like a specific thing that triggers it, you know? When they change, when they turn around and that specific thing, speak to a person who, let's say, was struggling with weight issues, right? And they realize one day that they have to deal with the weight issues, and they deal with the weight issues, right? So, are they usually going to be so successful when they deal just with the weight issue? Or it becomes sort of like they gain a general sense of, you know, I'm not in control as much, I'm not thinking as much, I'm not being, you know, clear enough in my life, I'm allowing things to get away from me. And now not only will they be more careful about what they eat, but they'll also be more punctual, and they'll be more this, and they'll be more, you know, considerate. It's very unusual where when it strikes home, it's localized.
This doesn't replace teshuva, does it? Always go hand in hand. You feel shame, and then you.
It doesn't replace the technical steps which a person is the steps which a person is still required to take. But when the Gemara says such a statement, he's embarrassed. He's forgiven for everything which he's done. You know, there's. You know, it's getting to the core and to the essence of tshuva. From a practical standpoint, we'll still tell him to take steps. But with that embarrassment, Hashem was ready to say, "Shol your mind." Right? Or Shmuel, in this case, said, "You're going to be with me in Olam Haba." Yeah.
It's Gemara where I think it's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. You know, he's telling us, Talmidim, on his deathbed, that you should be in bracha, should be as embarrassed in front of Hashem. Mm-hmm.
Fear of people should, the fear of Hashem should be upon you like the fear of people. Meira shamayim aleichem, kemeira basar b'dam. Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about? Like busha, I mean, I can see somebody sort of stealing a cookie, and then you see somebody notices them and they're embarrassed. You know, that feel embarrassed for that's a little different than sort of analyzing it and saying, you know, I can do better. That's not some kind of comparator, maybe.
Right. I'm not sure what to tell you. I'm struggling with the same question. What happens if the person's Eisod Var Avera Umisbayer Sheimana, he's embarrassed from it, but it's not really plugging in as an embarrassment before Hashem, it's more as an embarrassment from other people. How does that plug into this Gemara? How does that work with this Gemara? And when Shaul wasn't bringing this up, he wasn't bringing it up to Shmuel. Right, it was to him. Does that mean that he had a fundamental busha? I'm not sure. I imagine there could be such a thing, that the busha, that the embarrassment, is not so much conscience as it is just interpersonally motivated. But what's clear is that here there has to be something of a sense of conscience.
But if there's nobody around, what is busha? Is it like there's nobody around and I feel as if that strong?
No, there's a Rashi in the beginning of the second chapter of Pirkei Avos, which is a very important Rashi. The Mishnah says in the beginning of the second chapter of Pirkei Avos, Ezi derech teva she'ever le'adam, what's the right path for a person to choose? And he says, Kol she tiferes lo'isa v'tiferes le'min ha'adam. That which is tiferes, which usually we translate as, you know, glorious, harmonious for the person, and people acknowledge it as such. So what does that mean? He should choose a path which is glorious, right, for the one who does it, and people will glorify him from it. Well, he should try to be on the starting line of the ravens. You know, like, what does it mean? So Rashi says that there's no such thing as a person doing something which is bad that they won't feel a pang about it. And people have a sixth sense. And so he says, if you're facing a situation which is somewhat ambiguous, and you know that you could choose this path and it's going to feel right, and this path and it's not going to feel so right, pay attention to that. That's a little bit of this. That's that power of Misbaya Shemena. That's the conscience. You know, somebody once called me up with a shaila about a monetary issue, about paying somebody back. He owed money to a few people, and the question is, should we obviously borrow from this person first, but then he made some kind of a deal with the third guy, you know, whatever it was. And, he's telling it to me and trying to listen, and You know, always the caveat is you never know what the, you can't answer a monetary question without hearing both sides, you know, but you're trying to talk it through. I don't know, it sounds like maybe you should pay this guy. And that tells us, okay, but somehow it doesn't feel, I said, if it doesn't feel right to you, that means probably somewhere in that deal, you did say something else. I'm not going to tell you to do it. To go against it that way. That's what you have to realize. People do have that sense. If it doesn't feel right, then watch out. Now, that doesn't mean if it feels fine, that it is fine, because sometimes we manage to obliterate those feelings. But if it doesn't feel right, then pay good heed to that. And that's all part of this, and part of keeping the core, of keeping the conscience alive. It's a big thing.
So just a quick question. If somebody did develop the habit of doing, let's say, the wrong thing, would that feeling of not being right be the opposite, so to speak? In other words, like, they're so used to doing the wrong thing, for them, a feeling of this doesn't feel right actually might be the good thing, the good choice to make. Is it possible to be reversed for them?
Okay, one more time, let me hear it again.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but if you obliterate that feeling of busha for doing the wrong thing, then does it become when you're about to do the wrong thing that you might even get a shkoyach from your conscience? I think that's the idea, once it becomes like a mitzvah to you, that you might get a little turbocharge in doing the wrong thing may actually feel like the right thing.
It could be that it could reach such an extreme. I mean, that's sort of like a vitz, like a joke, which people say that if he does it second time, then it's as if it's okay. Mm-hmm. If he does it the third time, then it feels like something that he's supposed to do. But I'm not, I could imagine it could reach a point where the person has created such strong and firm defenses that they want to not be bothered by their conscience, that they push forward. Okay, let's move on to the next. And the next piece is citing a Gemara in Saita, and it's in the context of the Sota. And the Sota, who sort of has been hauled into the Beis HaMikdash, and she's about to have this drink, of the waters of the Saita that is a big, it's a big test, a big challenge. We're going to be erasing the name of Hashem to put into the potion. And if she can put this matter to rest without having to do this, then it would be a good thing. So we encourage her, if you want to just admit it, save everybody a lot of difficulty. So it says, we say before her, Divrei Agada Umasim She'iru B'Ksuvim HaRishayim. We tell her some stories, some biblical stories. For example, it brings a pasuk in Iyov, Asher Chachamim Yagidu V'Lekichadu Me'Avisam. The wise people spoke and they did not withhold. They did not withhold from their fathers. What does that mean? So it goes on and it says, the Mishnah, Yehuda Haida V'Lei Baish. Yehuda admitted. He admitted with the story of Tamar that it was him, that he had been with her. And it was she had engineered it for good reasons, but he was doing something which was not so positive. And he admitted and he wasn't embarrassed. And in the end, he was Zaychalach Yarash Chayelim Abba, Yarelim Abba. Reuven Haida V'Lei Baish. Reuven admitted. And he wasn't embarrassed when he did the story with Bila. And also, he was in Eilam Haba. And the Gemara says that they even have a schar in Eilam Haba, in Eilam Hazeh, that Lohem Levadam Nitna Haaretz V'Le'avar Zar B'Secham, they had specific privileges in this world as well. And nobody, no Zor, nobody else could sort of interfere between them, get in the way between them. So the Gemara goes on, how do you know Reuven Yehuda admitted is a pasuk? How do you know Reuven admitted? So the Gemara says Reuven learned from Yehuda and he admitted his sin as well. So the Maral is taking this out of that Gemara in Saita, the power of Hida, the power of Vidui, the power of admission. Here, like we've spoken here about one component of tshuva, which is embarrassment. And here we speak about another component of tshuva, a component which is on everybody's list, on the shortest list that we would have of components of tshuva. The Rambam's list of components of tshuva, one of the elements is, obviously, vidui, confession. That's a big part of tshuva, however you slice it. What is the power of vidui? What's the power of tshuva, of confession? In tshuva. What's it for? So there are different ways that people could understand the role of the vidui. One way to understand the role of the vidui, as the Rambam seems to say, is that to speak out your feelings, to articulate your feelings. Tzarech sheyemar inyanim elu shegomar b'libo, I think is the language of the Rambam, something like that. He has to articulate what he feels inside. Feelings are amorphous. They're sort of like mushing around in there. When you come and you say it out, it makes it that much more real. And some would say that, look, you can feel it, but at a certain point, there's an aspect of Shuva El Hashem. You have to go to Hashem and you have to speak to Him. And if you feel bad towards somebody else, that's very nice, but you have to communicate with them in order to be able to get over it. And we have to do the same thing with Hashem Yisparach. The Maral here speaks here, and this is the principal place where he speaks about it, is here in this perek, and he says a piece here and a piece, a little piece later, is that Haida, admission, confession, is beyond that. And yes, it ties into one of the core principles which we have, which is that tshuva is to Hashem, is reconnecting to Hashem. But, Michael mentioned before the idea of, the embarrassment creates the humility, and when there's humility, there's the possibility of connection to Hashem. In a great sense, that's what the Maral's interpreting here about vidui. He says, vidui is an admission. I'm telling the Rabbanu Shel Olam, I really needed to do something different. I needed to do what you expected of me, what you wanted of me, and I failed in that regard. And in that sense, says the Maral, Vidui is giving yourself over to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, giving yourself over to Hashem. Vidui is the person giving himself over to Hashem. And that's the bitul, that's the negation of the Yetzer Hara. So let's try to understand what these words mean. Let's try to understand what they mean. You know, Rav Huttner has a maimer, has an essay in the Pachad Yitzchak, I think on Chanukah, where he points out that there are two words in Hebrew. There's one word in Hebrew, excuse me, that has two meanings, and that is moedim, or hoda. The word lehodot, in whatever form, can mean to express gratitude, moedim anachnu lach, and it can mean also to admit, or to confess. A hoda'ah, right, a sudas hoda'ah, is a feast of thanksgiving. Hodas baldin is, I admit I really do owe you $10,000. What's the common quality between these two things? And think about it. In Shemoneh Esrei, we don't bow much. We bow at the beginning and end of the first bracha of the Shemoneh Esrei, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Hasheinu, and the end of that bracha is Baruch Atah Hashem Magen Avraham. We bow at the beginning and the end of the first bracha of the davening. And then one other time, at the beginning and the end of the bracha of Hoda, of Maidim Anachnu Lach. You bow there. And what do you do when you say Vidui on Yom Kippur? You're also supposed to say it when you are. You pronounce it bowed or bowed? Right? Bowed. Right? But you bow and you say it in that posture. Maidim Hoda. What's the idea? What do the two of them have in common? Saying thank you and saying I admit that I owe you something? Like, what is it? Well, that's exactly what it is. Gratitude is the acknowledgement that I have this only because of you. So I owe you something. Right? If you lend me $10,000 and I'm supposed to give it back to you, then I admit that you gave me $10,000 means I admit that I owe you $10,000. If you gave me $10,000 as a present, when I say thank you, it's I owe you something. Because I only have this $10,000 because of you. Now, you told me I don't owe you $10,000, but I owe you the weight of $10,000 in gratitude for what you've done. Why is it difficult to be grateful? Because you're dependent. Many times, people will even not want to take something from somebody because they know that if they take something from that somebody, they're going to have to be grateful to that somebody. They're going to feel indebted and humble before that somebody. So in order to be able to maintain their independence, they don't want to take something from them. Now, many times that's fine and appropriate and healthy. And sometimes, of course, it's unhealthy. When it's really needed, when the person really should take it, and they don't want to take it. So the thing is that their need, their pride, to make sure that they are there, are them themselves alone, they're able to do it alone, is too strong to allow them to even do what's necessary. Because, to some degree, they want to also perpetuate this feeling in their head and in their heart that they are able to do it alone. One of the most fundamental feelings that a Jew is supposed to have is gratitude. Where? Right, we're called Yehudim. What's Yehudim is from the term Hoda, from the name Yehuda. Yehuda was named Yehuda, why? Because Leah said when she gave birth to her fourth son, Hapam Odes Hashem. Now I can give thanks to Hashem. Now I express my gratitude to Hashem. That's where the name Yehuda came from. And parenthetically, why does Yehuda become the king? Because Haida V'loy Baish. Because he acknowledged. He admitted in the story of Tamar, and he wasn't embarrassed. Yehuda ata yoiducha achecha, the beginning of Yaakov's bracha to Yehuda, yoiducha achecha is your brothers will acknowledge you as the leader, says the Targum, Yehuda, at odisa velo vehisisa, you admitted and you weren't ashamed. You were able to, in other words, you weren't too afraid to admit it. Not that he wasn't proud of it, right? But the idea was, he wasn't too big to admit it. Where does that come from? It comes from the same gratitude that happened before. Right? Everybody knows that why did Leah say, now I want to thank Hashem? Because she made a calculation. Right? Rashi says, there are four wives, there's supposed to be 12 shvatim, 12 sons. That means 12 divided by 4 is 3. I just had my fourth son. So what does that mean? It means I got more than my portion. In other words, even in sons, to some degree, there was a sense of, I deserve this. But when you get something that clearly is beyond your expectations, beyond what you deserve, you say, then I have to be grateful. Well, haidah, thankfulness, gratefulness, gratitude, is supposed to be that the person says, you know something, if not for, I couldn't be here. When you realize that what you have is because of somebody else, in a sense, you've given yourself to that somebody else. When you're sort of like standoffish a little bit, you know, you can't recognize that. It's very difficult. Right? People, sometimes, the indebtedness that they have with somebody else, to somebody else, excuse me for sounding like too much of a psychologist, but it's so sometimes threatening and overwhelming that it creates the greatest distance between those two people. You know, sometimes the person, right, who did it, you know, people say, and this is like a sort of one of those cynical statements, but that unfortunately has a little truth to it, says, I really would want to help him more, but I don't want him to hate me. You know, if you give somebody something so much, and for them to face that and realize that who they are is so much dependent on you, that would force them to say, I'm here because of you. Ouch. That's a difficult statement to make. That's the admission, gratitude, I don't know what to call it, balance, synthesis, conundrum, it's all of them. Those two struggle with each other. So for a person to turn to Hashem and to say, Hashem, you know something? I don't have a right to make my own decisions and do whatever I want. You told me what's right, and that's what I'm supposed to do. I owe fidelity to your word. You're the creator, and you're the master of the world. You are my melech, you are my king, and therefore I understand. I understand what I have to do, and I understand what I've done wrong. That's the person giving themselves over to Hashem. I want you to just, I want to formulate it in a way which is very Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur Dick, you know, fits the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur model, to perhaps make it a little bit more understandable. We have Rosh Hashanah followed by Yom Kippur. You know, classic question, why do we have it that way? Yom Kippur is the day when we do tshuva, when we ask forgiveness. It would seem to maybe be wise to do that before the Day of Judgment rather than after the Day of Judgment. You know, when you have a cooperative defendant in a case, and from day one he's saying, I admit it, I'm wrong, and so on and so forth, and works nicely with the prosecution or whatever it is, so he's more likely to get clemency than the fellow who fights it and resists it. And then when the judge decides that he's supposed to be in jail for 30 years, or he decides that he's guilty and he's deciding within the sentencing guidelines what to do, he comes forth and he says, you know, I'm sorry. Too little, too late. Wouldn't it make sense for the forgiveness to come before the Day of Judgment? It's famous kasha attributed to Ritzel Petterbrugger, whatever, to others. So there are many ways to approach this question, but think here about one way to approach the question. The Aseres Hadibros, the Ten Commandments, was when Hashem first came to the Jewish people to speak to us. And the first of the Ten Commandments is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God. And then the rest of the commandments, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, you know, as we learned about it in the Maral and Tiferes Yisrael, the ambiguousness of the statement, is it a commandment or a statement? A commandment is usually don't worship other gods, keep Shabbos, daven, don't swear falsely, right? But to say I am Hashem your God, is that a commandment? So some understand, yeah, it's a commandment of emunah. It's a commandment of believing in Hashem your God. Some say, no, it's not a commandment. It's an introduction. Chazal, without getting into this issue of saying, well, is it a commandment or is it just a statement, say that it goes in two distinct steps, which is, Kablu Malchusai, or Malchusi, accept my kingdom. Accept me as God. And then, Kablu Zeraisai. Then, let me tell you what to do. In other words, commandment presumes something. And what's that? The nature of the connection, that he has the right to command me. So now, oh, you have asserted that you're the king. I accept that you're the king. So now, tell me what to do. Right? You go to work and somebody says, do this. I understand exactly who you are. So this, oh, you're new here. I'm the supervisor. Okay, I know I'm not the guy who hired you, but I'm the supervisor. Oh, you're the supervisor. Okay, now tell me what to do. But otherwise, it's just some nudnik in the cubicle next door telling you what to do. Like, why should you listen to them? Kablu machusai v'achach kablu zeiraisai. Parenthetically, that's the same order of Kriya Shema. The Mishnah says in Brachas, the first paragraph of Kriya Shema, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, is Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemaim, is accepting that Hashem is our King. The second paragraph of Kriya Shema is Kabbalas Ol Mitzvahs, is getting into the specifics of the instructions. If you listen to my mitzvahs, this will happen, that will happen. First step is to establish that V'loy Anachnu, we're His. And then He tells us what to do. Yom Kippur is the day of the details. Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu, A to Z, Aleph to Tav. Right? We go through the whole list, the whole litany. Right? And these are the short ones, by the way. You know, there are other viduyim, you know, like the Chidah and others that give you many, many more things if you're struggling with something to fill the time. So the Yom Kippur is the day of the details. Rosh Hashanah. We don't say Ashamnu once. Right? There are different reasons why we don't mention our Chatoim on Rosh Hashanah, for all kinds of reasons. But what do we do on Rosh Hashanah? What we do on Rosh Hashanah is we are accepting Malchus Shamayim. It's Imru Lefanai Malchus. We declare Hashem as King. So that's the structure. The structure is like at Har Sinai, like in Kriya Shema. Accept Malchus. And then let's talk about the rules. Vidui comes with a presumption of malchus. If I'm going to say to somebody, I apologize for doing something, the assumption is not just the detail of the commandment that this thing is something wrong, but that I owe to you to speak about what I do, to account for my actions. That's me giving myself over to Hashem. Says the Maharal, when you give yourself over to Hashem, that's Olam Haba. Olam Hazeh, this world, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, the fourth most basic factor of this world is, I'm not giving over to Hashem. I'm my own. I'm not dependent. And Hashem told Adam HaRishon, you can have whatever you want. Just one thing. So did Adam HaRishon eat everything in the garden and then he was just saying, but I wish I could have some of that? And everything else looked fantastic. They looked delicious. Right? They were nechmad. Everything was beautiful. It doesn't describe the Eitz HaDaat as being more attractive than anything else. It just describes it as being attractive. All the trees. Kol Eitz Nechmad Lamara V'Tayv L'Machal. All the trees were good. So everybody knows, why did Adam HaRishon want to eat from the Eitz HaDaat? Because Hashem told him not to. So what's the psychology of Hashem told him not to, so therefore he wants to eat it? That's the psychology of independence. Of not wanting to be told what to do. Of not wanting to be dependent. Of not wanting to give yourself over to somebody else. To surrender. When the snake talked Chava into eating from the Eitz HaDaat, what did he say to her? He said, Hashem isn't letting you eat from the Eitz HaDaat, not because it's going to kill you. Right? You think Hashem said eat all these delicious fruits because they're delicious, but don't eat from the Eitz HaDaat because on the day that you eat from it, you're going to die. It's poison. It's bad. Nah. The reason why Hashem doesn't want you to eat from it is because on the day that you eat from it, you'll be like Hashem. And Hashem doesn't want competition. He wants you to be a struggling dependent of His. So she ate it. Olam Hazeh is something which can be, quote unquote, in certain ways it can't at all be, but in certain ways it can be independent of Hashem. Just walk outside and look. Right, we act. The world, you know, is this a world which is filled with the active presence of Hashem? Would the advertisements on the sides of city buses look like that if this is a world which was filled with the active presence of Hashem? Would we be commemorating September 11th if the world was an active presence of Hashem? So the world is able to be independent. And the whole trick, the whole purpose of the world is to say, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, it's yours. Right? When you eat something, you can just eat it. Or you can say, blessed are you Hashem who gave me this fruit. And then you surrender and you say, Hashem, the world is yours. And then Hashem says, yeah, it's mine, and I'm letting you have it. Because if you acknowledge and you give yourself to me, I share with you. If you try to pull it out of my hands, you're a thief. If you take something without saying thank you, then you're a thief. You may not owe the person money, right? But you're a thief. To acknowledge is to give yourself to Hashem. That's the core of Haidah. Forget the specific words that you say. I acknowledge, I admit that I did X. Forget all the other things, which should be done. Right? Because you have to be very clear about what you did wrong. Forget that an important part of the vidui is to say, and Rabbeinu Shalom, I'll feel bad, and I want to, and so on and so forth. Just the fact that you feel that you have to go to Hashem and account for what you've done. The opening of vidui, when you go and get ready to land that first pound on the breast, you've already given yourself over to Hashem. Don't stop there. But that's the fundamental thing. Says the Maharal, that's it. That's the height of Olei Baish. It says the Maharal, beautiful. He says, and that's why the Chazal continue, and they bring the pasuk and they say, "V'lo avar zar b'seichem," and nobody can get between Reuven and Yehuda. Why not? Yehuda admitted to his sin, which happened in one place at one time. Reuven admitted to his sin, which happened in one place. Well, it's not like this was a chveis, you know, the and I'm blanking on the names of criminal gangs, but I could think of one, you know, and they went and they were driving around their convertible from bank to bank and holding people up around their horses, right? And then they admitted together to their crime, and they were a band for bad, and now they're a band for good, and they lived happily ever after, right? Then you say, but Yehuda did one thing, Reuven did another. Like, what's going on? But he says, people who are ready to surrender their quote-unquote independence and give themselves over to and say, Hashem, we're yours, that removes any gaps between them. Because what creates the gaps between people is everybody's sense of who they are, of their independence. Our independent streak is what creates who we are, and which makes me sort of like a little arm's length with you, because you're a little bit, you know, a little bit of competition here, and so on and so forth, and I have my thing and you have yours. But when we say, we realize what we have from Him, we end up on the same team. We end up having given ourselves to Hashem, and nothing can divide us.
That takes the greatest act of courage any human being can do, to give yourself over to Hashem.
Why do you say it's more than a human being? It's a big, big thing,
survive,
huh?
Survive, we have to have an ego. Or we don't, sense of independence. So if you're handing yourself over, it's almost contradictory to this particular world that we live in. I mean, it's huge.
It's huge.
I mean, very few people can do it.
It's absolutely huge. And as I say, it's the quote unquote the original sin. And it's every struggle that we have. It's when the Jewish people didn't want to go into Eretz Yisrael. What were they worried about? They don't remember that there was such a thing as Kriyas Yamsuf? Of course they remember there was such a thing as Kriyas Yamsuf, as the splitting of the sea and as Hashem doing all kinds of miracles. But we're going to have to keep going places where the only way we can make it is if you help us out? We want to be independent already, Hashem.
I mean, literally, our
so absolutely, I agree.
Become one.
I agree with you. I don't want to use the word impossible. But I want to say it's the most existential challenge which a person has.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's why the elderly are become more dependent and still thin, because they're getting closer to going to Olamas. And it's a difficult thing, because they've been independent, the providers at the top of their game, and now physically as well as mentally, they don't have
that's it. Very good. It's very, very good. And always we always have said over, and I think even maybe last week we touched upon it, that the, or maybe it wasn't in this year, a different one, that the Maral's theory of Zikna, why we honor the older, is because, you know, their passions for all kinds of, you know, material things, which tend to cloud our judgment on what's really important, because those have receded a little bit, so therefore they see more clearly what's important. But you're saying one of those things, and you're adding, one of those things is that, you know, people who are, you know, bigger and growing are always, you know, flexing their muscles of independence. And as the person gets older, if they accept their age, you know, sort of gracefully, and they say, you know, now I need a little help, so then that fierce sense of having to be independent doesn't interfere anymore with being able to recognize and be able to submit to be in somebody else's hands. Very nice. Very nice stuff.
You mentioned about our how Hashem gives us permission to benefit from this world, but only if we acknowledge first, say a bracha first, otherwise it's stealing. Perhaps I think it goes even a bit farther, because isn't it true that Hashem really wants us to take control of the world? He wants to give us the world to perfect it. But if we do that as, whatever the metaphor would be, the tip of the spear, if we know that He's the spear, but we're the tip of it, if we take control of the world as an extension of Him to do it for His purposes, then we get His support and His connection with Him. But if we think we're the spear itself, if we try to take control of the world independently of Him, separated from His intentions, then that leads to what we've got today, the destruction and the decline of civilization. So that it goes beyond just getting to benefit from the world. It even goes so far as to take control over the world.
Okay, so that's the aside. That's the principle which he puts here, and I think it's a big principle. I think it's a big idea. Very, very chashuva idea. And you know, to think of it again, to go over it, haidah, admission, gratitude, it's all in a sense a surrender of the person's independence. And you know, getting into the details, like I say, there's Rosh Hashanah before Yom Kippur. And Rosh Hashanah, that's the avoda, that's the work. To realize it's his world. To accept Hashem as the king. Now let's deal more. Let's deal with specifics. We go on, Aseres Mitzvah Yom Kippur, and we deal with specifics. But Mesiras Atzmei L'Hashem Yisbarach, that's like the cleansing. That's the beginning of it all. That's the beginning of the establishment of the whole connection. Okay, I thought maybe we would do the whole parak, but I was smart enough not to say that we would. We learned from experience. And we'll Mirat Hashem have to be mashlim, have to complete it the next time. Now, I want to mention, maybe just ask, I am supposed to be traveling next Sunday. I'm going to be here for Shabbos, but I'm supposed to be traveling to two cities next Sunday. So I have to leave very, very early in the morning. I know sometimes when I have a substitute, he gets into this thing of talking to himself. I want, if the Olam will welcome, if any request of someone to substitute, that would be great. I would hate to see the Bittul Torah. So if anybody has an idea, you know, I would like if guys could come. I mean, if any subs we'll get will certainly be time well spent. there's a suggestion.
Do you have a friend in Silver Spring?
I do have a friend in Silver Spring. I don't know if I could ask him to come for 8:30 on a Sunday morning, especially because my friend in Silver Spring doesn't drive.
The substitute would be for purposes of continuing where we are, or do another topic.
I'm too selfish to let him do exactly to continue where we are, because I want to learn the whole thing with you. Something related to the topic of tshuva, huh? If you really like, we can do it a different time. Or if you like, I could do it. We've done it before. I could record it during the week if you'll sit and watch it and listen to it. I'm happy to do that. So if somebody will give me guidance. A different time from experience will be hard to find one that will work for everybody for whom Sunday morning at 8:35 works. Yeah.
Just as a suggestion, I personally like learning it live, not Memorex, with the rug. And what we got together next week and just did Hazara.